Welcome back to That's Politics, where I break down the political news for the intellectual and curious mind. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and today we have another installment of the DEI series. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking about academic freedom in relation to DEI concepts, which I teach to you at the end of the last episode. Speaking of last episode, I'm going to give you a recap of what I covered, but as always, if you haven't listened to part 2, go back and listen to get a full grasp on DEI being taught in college classrooms. Let's kick off the recap with number 1. Letters have been sent out by the Department of Education and the UNC system about following President Trump's January 21st executive order. Number 2. The Dear Colleague letter has made many claims about academic institutions, saying that they are discriminating against racial groups by using DEI in their admissions processes. Number 3. Academic professionals are very apprehensive about talking about DEI concepts with the media and in their classrooms. And finally, number 4. Caroline Pendry, in her interview, emphasized the importance of being able to talk about these issues and view them through an academic and statistical lens. Now that we're all caught up, let's get into academic freedom. To start off, let's define academic freedom. According to the American Association of University Professors, academic freedom is defined as, quote, freedom of a teacher or researcher in higher education to investigate and discuss the issues in his or her academic field, and to teach and publish findings without interference from administrators, board of trustees, political figures, donors, or other entities. Academic freedom also protects the right of a faculty member to speak freely when participating in institutional governments, as well as to speak freely as a citizen, unquote. In general, it is the freedom to teach what you want to teach, and faculty members can act as members of our democracy without punishment. This concept of academic freedom also falls under the Humboldtian model for higher education, which started in about the 1800s. This is the expectation that universities can govern themselves. Like you know, I attended WCU, and for the process of forming program curricula, like other higher education institutions, it starts in the faculty's hands. The professors get together and formulate a curriculum that aligns with their academic accreditations. Now let's jump down a rabbit hole about academic accreditations real quick so you can kind of get a gist of what I'm talking about. Think of accreditations as the checklist that professional fields expect graduates to have experience in. The best example I can think of is for the nursing programs. They have this thing called the Commission on Collegiate Nursing Education, which makes sure that residency programs prepare people to work in the field. Many other programs have something very similar. Attending and graduating from an accredited university means that you meet the standards of the field. Well, some accreditors require some sort of DEI concept courses to prepare students for the populations they may deal with once they hit the workforce. Last episode, we briefly mentioned programs at Western potentially having to change the names of some of their classes required for the major. The specific program was the Criminal Justice Program. If you don't know, the Criminal Justice Program prepares students to work in law enforcement in some way. It can range from working as a police officer or working in the court system. The program has this thing called Diversity and Ethics in Criminal Justice. Courses under this section include Gender and Crime, Comparative Criminal Justice Systems, Ethics in Criminal Justice, and Minorities, Crimes, and Social Policy. The goal of these courses is to expose students to different problems they will experience when they get into the field. It is required that graduates have some sort of diversity training, or how it's being referred to now, cultural competency training, that is required by the accreditors. Crawling out of our rabbit hole, faculty create the curriculum in alignment with the academic accreditations and then send it to the faculty governing body at the university. At Western, it's our faculty senate. The governing body then goes through and makes sure that it's good and then passes it, which then becomes the curriculum for the specific program. The faculty members within the program then formulate their syllabi in compliance with the approved curriculum. Professors and instructors choose how they wish to execute the curriculum. This could be through how they structure their classroom, how they teach, are they lectures and slideshows, or are they shooting for a discussion-led classroom style? They get to create their own syllabus for each semester. And it may vary from other professors who teach the same course, but the goals of the different syllabi are the same. Academic freedom also finds itself within the research professors do while working at their universities. The whole concept of research is that new information is being gathered and new observations are being explained. researchers tend to develop old concepts more, or they completely discredit old assumptions in favor of new assumptions based on the findings of their research. To expand on new fields of knowledge, you must acknowledge and admit the existence of different groups of people for their research. As we've mentioned, DEI can encompass many different groups of people which have been the subject of new research because these minority groups are, surprise, surprise, under-researched. Now, funding for research, specifically about DEI concepts, have been cut by the federal government. The February 5th memo that we talked about in the last episode talks about how funding may be withheld depending on the decision from the agency the university seeks to contract with. You can probably see why this would be a problem, but I will explain this more towards the end of the episode. Now the question you're probably thinking about, and it may be lingering from the last episode, is when is it okay to talk about DEI in classrooms and to research DEI topics? When I consider this question, I like to think about the fields that may discuss these topics, which tends to be any field that has to deal with the public, which is kind of like all of them. Medical fields need to discuss discrepancies in care of minority patients. Think about maternal mortality rate of Black women and how the medical care system has ignored them for centuries and still discredits their pain to this day. Engineering fields may have to consider how their creations will be used by minority groups. An example of this may be wheelchair accessibility of a new building. I know last episode, Caroline talked about how Google had to change the way their Google Meets worked so that it would accommodate people of darker skin color on the camera and on the screen. The only field that I do not really see DEI being part of the conversation is like a math concentration in college. If you can think of an example of this, please drop a comment or send a message because I'm drawing a blank here. Now, there is a fine line that professors and instructors walk when it comes to teaching these topics and pushing their opinions onto students. I believe this is how they go about holding and mediating the discussion. If professors, and I've had some do this, present their perspectives and then shut down others while in a discussion-based class, that's not so good. The flip side of this is allowing debate in a classroom and mediating it so they do not get out of hand. I've also been in classes where some quote-unquote perspectives are just name-calling and picking a fight with other students in class. It is not a constructive debate. As Caroline said in the last episode, we have to stick to the facts and the research to present in debates or in class discussions. If these professors are talking about DEI in the classroom, they are more than likely backing it up with peer-reviewed research and know what they are talking about within the setting DEI is brought up in. But it is a practice of academic freedom that has developed research into DEI topics and the teaching of solutions to problems DEI seeks to address. Turning to present-day discussions, many are concerned about the attacks or perceived attacks on academic freedom. If you Google academic freedom, you'll come across some worries about the Trump administration targeting universities and academic freedom. At the time that I'm writing and recording this, it is the beginning of June, and the Trump administration and Harvard are going head-to-head in the news. This might seem a bit of a stretch to connect Trump versus Harvard to academic freedom, but stay with me here. It all started with a letter sent to Harvard in mid-April about the turning over of documentation of international students participating in protests as part of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Well, Harvard gave the White House the bird and said take it somewhere else because they aren't turning over 5 years worth of documentation. That didn't go over well with the Trump admin, and the Department of Homeland Security attempted to revoke Harvard's ability to admit international students, which would wipe out a quarter of their student body. This action was blocked by a judge, and the hearings are set for July as of this recording, on June 2nd. Now give me a second to connect this back to academic freedom. For starters, the Humboldt model, like we talked about earlier, is all about universities governing themselves. If there is a violation of their student code of conduct, they handle it in-house. And second, Harvard has made a stand saying that they will not hand over students who express their displeasure with the U.S. government, which is protected by the First Amendment, which is also the same case for international students here on an F1 visa. You can Google it and I'll link it in the show notes, but international students here on F1 visas get First Amendment protections. But I need to clarify that academic freedom does not mean First Amendment protections. Referencing the American Association of University Professors again, they point out that the First Amendment allows for the equality of all ideas, whereas academia believes in the inequality of knowledge based on research and factuality. They also identify that the First Amendment is about the individual, and academic freedom is regulated by peers and disciplinary competency. But I think there's a gap that I haven't talked about yet. Why does the government want or have a hand in controlling what is taught? In the US, there are 50 different types of curriculum standards. Each state has their own expectations for the public schools to accomplish and what courses are required for a student to graduate. I graduated from high school in Michigan, and when I talk about my experience with my friends who graduated in North Carolina, we have classes that the other didn't take. But that is K-12. The federal government doesn't have much say in that because the 10th Amendment implies that the power over education is reserved to the states. But the goal of state curriculums is that they can assure that each student that goes through the public system is being taught the same thing no matter where they live within the state. The difference between K-12 and higher education is that universities have the ability to decide their own curriculum and exercise this ability through aligning their curriculum with the professional fields that they prepare their students to go into, like we talked about at the top of the episode. Now, I don't really have a good way to do this, but I'm going to transition into my interview with today's expert. I have Dr. Yancey Gully here, who has been working in higher education for over 22 years and is currently a professor and program director in the Higher Education Student Affairs Program at WCU. He is going to tell us more about academic freedom and his experience with it. All right, and it is now recording. So let's get into the questions I got. So your main field of study and teaching is in higher ed. Your main field of study and teaching is in higher education. What led you to that field and that career?
When I was an undergrad, my last 2 years were at UNC Wilmington, and I had jobs all over campus and was really what involved student with student government and clubs and orgs, a communication studies major. And my vice chancellor for student affairs had me in her office one day talking about some project or another, and she asked what I was going to do for a living.
Oh, no.
Right. I said, I don't know. I'm a comm studies major. I wasn't sure what that career was going to be. And she said, you should work on a college campus and be in student affairs. This is really where you will thrive. She sent me out of her own pocket money to a conference, and it really changed everything. And I've started doing this ever since. So I had my first job in higher ed full time in 2000.
Oh, wow.
And I've worked in higher ed ever since for 15 years as an administrator all over the country. And then I decided I wanted better hours. And so I decided to be faculty. And so now I teach people how to kind of run universities, work with student development.
Okay. Have you faced any challenges while teaching that were a direct result of policy changes from either the institution you were teaching at or from the government?
I have not really had to change my teaching, and that's because of academic freedom and shared governance. Both of those things have allowed my classroom to remain intact in terms of my curriculum.
Can you talk me through like the academic freedom portion that the faculty go through to create the curriculum that you guys end up using in your classrooms?
That's a great question. People oftentimes misconstrue what academic freedom is. People often think it means I, as a faculty member, can go into my classroom, no matter what the subject matter is, and say whatever I want to about whatever topic is out there. That's not necessarily what it actually means. It means that the curriculum lives in the hands of the faculty writ large, and your discipline. So it means that in my program, the faculty get together and we get to decide what our curriculum looks like, the overarching learning outcomes, the overarching goals, what types of courses are going to get us to those ends. We also get to design the learning outcomes within those courses. Now, then as an individual faculty member, I do have the freedom to get to those ends in a way that maybe my colleague would go differently.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean we're going rogue talking about something totally unrelated to course content.
Okay.
And so we have that freedom to kind of do manage our classrooms, but not beyond the curricular outcomes designed by a collective faculty. And that those collective faculty are at the program level, the department level, the college level, and the university level.
How much of that decision making is decided or governed, or let me rephrase this. How much of the deciding of what goes in the curriculum, how you guys are going to get to your end goal, determined by your academic accreditations?
That's an excellent question. Not every discipline has an accreditation for their academics. Mm-hmm. Some do. We think a lot of times, I'm in the College of Education and Allied Professions, we talk about KCREP all the time, which has to do with kind of K-12 education, a few other things. For example, Higher Education Student Affairs, we are not accredited as a program. And there are many programs that are not. But those programs do use standards of their fields.
Okay.
I know of no discipline that doesn't have some version of standards of their fields, usually developed by people in the professional organizations that represent those fields, with lots of diverse input and so forth. So in my field, we have the competencies. There are 10 competencies that our profession has said are paramount to people going into the field having. And so we have designed our curriculum around these 10 competencies. And those competencies have been developed by not just one group, not just two groups, but input of tons of professional organizations that represent what we do.
I haven't had like a lot of people tell me exactly what their accreditation standards are. I've had one of my faculty advisors trying to explain it for the communication department. But again, communication, education, sociology, biology, the whole thing, like it's all very different and very complex.
Yeah, you will see accreditation standards for almost any program. I don't want to be absolute in this, but I can't think of one that's not, if there's licensure involved to do the job in the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can imagine that if there's going to be a licensure involved, the organization that grants licensure is probably going to want to say in what the curriculum looks like. And so they're going to credit the curriculum, that, which means they're going to visit the institution, make sure they're doing things right, up to standard, so that they know when they get a graduate who takes the licensure exam and passes it, they can be sure as a field that they're putting the faith into this person. Some fields don't have those kind of licensure demands to do the work, so they might not have accreditation standards. There are some that might, but it's not kind of a required thing in the kind of domain of work.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your teaching philosophy revolving around cultural diversity, social inequality, and social justice?
I believe that education is paramount to the success of a nation. Mm-hmm. I believe that a nation is built up of diverse individuals with unique backgrounds, perspectives, needs, desires. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine teaching without bringing in perspectives of many people, without highlighting the perspectives of maybe those who are less heard. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean giving them more airtime. It means highlighting them because they haven't had airtime. Right. So I can't imagine teaching without social justice at the core of it, because social justice is not social justice for some people.
Okay.
It's for all people. We often think of social justice being about one group of people or certain groups of people, and that's not the case. So in my mind, education needs to be educating about everything and not just one version of everything or everything for just one group of people. And so that inclusion, equity, and social justice idea in my teaching philosophy, it means I'm holding myself accountable for not just the perspectives that I have based on my lived experience or my belief system or my value system, but bringing in those of all kinds of folks. So those really just hold me accountable. They're not about changing people's minds necessarily. They're about opening people's minds to perspectives they might not hold along with myself at any given time.
You touched on this already a little bit, but can you explain what academic freedom is and why it is important in an academic setting?
Yes, academic freedom is It came around kind of at the turn of the century, kind of started in 1890 and was fleshed out in kind of the early 20s, because faculty were feeling like they could not challenge some standard ways of thinking, right? Okay. And so academic freedom kind of came about to say, hey, you as a faculty member, part of your job is to do research. Mm-hmm. Research produces new knowledge or challenges current knowledge. If I were hindered in my ability to talk about that, change would never happen. People would never think. You know, my job as a faculty member is to challenge, to educate, to push our civilization forward. We would stagnate if researchers and faculty had not pushed us forward, right? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't, if for the research done on college campuses, we would not have half the technology we have in the world because it's here. But sometimes that technology that we might be developing, someone might think, oh, I don't want that to be developed because I'm scared of that. So academic freedom allows us to do that kind of research that might be necessary to make people uncomfortable, because change is uncomfortable, just like learning, right? About cognitive dissonance, learning is not comfortable. We need to be uncomfortable to learn. Academic freedom protects me in many ways as a faculty to make people uncomfortable.
I love the idea of being uncomfortable about these types of conversations, because it's almost like I would consider the anti-DEI policy is an attack on the attack of status quos. Does that like make sense? Is that kind of how you perceive it?
Yeah, I think it's one way to think about it. Some of the anti-DEI policies that are out there coming from multiple sources, sometimes they are reactionary to larger cultural context, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have their own motivations, depending on what place they're coming from. But to say we shouldn't be talking about diversity, mm-hmm. Well, what is diversity to people? Do you mean I shouldn't acknowledge the person in my classroom who is of a different race or ethnicity? Does it mean I shouldn't even acknowledge there's a difference between the man sitting in my classroom and the woman sitting in my classroom? The trans person in my classroom? Does it mean I don't get to notice or even recognize the value of someone else's lived experience? So to say take away DEI work, it means take away the identities of everyone in the space, if we're really getting to the root of it. I don't know how you not acknowledge it. I wonder what's next. Are we going to have to just stop asking race, ethnicity on applications for admission? Are we going to have to stop asking people about their gender? On application materials. If we take this to the nth degree, we get to a really strange place. So the anti-DEI policies, I understand their aim, whether I agree with them or not. I think they're difficult to implement on the small, minute level because it would demand us to have blinders on about everything, even those who are blind and those who can see.
So why is academic freedom important for the health of a society or a democracy?
Let me read you something.
Okay.
That I have said in a public forum before. So this is not anything that the public has not had access to previously. The scrutiny facing our institutions of higher education is not simply aimed at some nebulous organization, but directly at the humans who provide it life. We must support each other in our work, and we must recognize that many faculty are tired, disheartened, and frankly scared about the future. At this time, I believe we need to not just defend the work of higher education, but to champion it. We must uphold the trust between the citizenry and the academy that places higher education as a beacon of wisdom, a harbinger of thought, an usher of new ideas, and an inquisitor into the assumptions of normative and traditional cultural and socio-political ways of being. Higher education is not just value added in the equation of a thriving democracy. It is necessary for its very existence.
That is heavy hitting.
I stood by that then and now as just a public statement of my personal beliefs about the value of higher education in our current climate.
So why are conversations about DEI healthy for a society, especially in the context of academia and teaching future generations about differences between people?
Cultural evolution is necessary for humanity to exist now and into the future. The globe changes. The country next door changes. Our neighbor changes. We live here in Western North Carolina, many of us. Our lives have been changed by Hurricane Helene and the current wildfires. We have had to learn new ways of engaging with each other. We have had to learn something about our neighbors that we may not have known before. We may have taken in someone with a different belief system than we have because what united us was our need for survival. That learning about them, that helping them despite different beliefs, that's what we call growth. If we weren't open to growth, then we wouldn't move anywhere as a society. And if we don't move anywhere as a society, stagnation is not an option. Stagnation puts us as individuals behind, it puts the collective behind, and it puts our nation at stake in our place on the world stage. So, you know, I think that we have to focus on learning, growth, development, change. And I know change makes people uncomfortable, but change can have different ways of meaning. It could be tiny, it could be large. But if we don't learn and grow, and we do that a lot through higher education and other forms of knowledge acquisition, we're not going to get anywhere as a country. We're not going to get anywhere as a people. We're not going to get anywhere as a neighbor or a neighborhood.
Thank you so much for coming here and talking to us a little bit about academic freedom.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. I love talking about this. You just ask my students who take the history of higher education course. Which we talk a lot about academic freedom.
From what I see, I believe that the push for the U.S. government to regulate college curriculums and thus the crackdown on academic freedom is to push more pro-American beliefs. Academic freedom allows for what right-leaning people in the Trump admin call anti-American rhetoric. But a key part of developing a society is that we have to look at ourselves through a critical lens to identify problems that are holding us back. Picking out our faults is not anti-American, but rather the complete opposite, because we want to improve our country. When talking with people about DEI being taught in colleges, a reoccurring phrase kept on coming up. People don't want it forced on them. And I call BS on this. If people are not confronted with the facts of their society, then they will never improve or change. When I talk with my mom and dad about things like this, they always say that they were never taught things like that when they were in school. But I think that is the problem. Older generations, our parents and grandparents, were never confronted with the problems in our society, and it just kept on getting swept under the rug. The difference today is that my generation, Gen Z, sees the problems every day. We see a new protest or another act of police brutality every time we open one of our many social media apps. We are interconnected like never before, and we use this opportunity to talk about and bring light to the problems that we see. If we don't talk about it, if we are not allowed to talk about it, we will decline as a democracy. I would like to point out that academic freedom and education play a key role in democracies. In autocratic countries, academic freedom is significantly lower than in liberal democracies like in the US. The VDEM Index, which tracks democracy health across the globe, has an indicator titled Academic Freedom Index. For this indicator, 1 means healthy and 0 means not healthy. The US scores a 0.68. Comparatively, Russia scored 0.21, Turkey scored 0.12, China scored 0.07, and North Korea scored 0.02. Education is one of the most regulated aspects of life in autocracies. Democracies, on the other hand, thrive on an educated population. Higher education teaches people about how to be contributing members of democracies, which we will get into next episode. Thank you for tuning into That's Politics this week, where we broke down DEI through the lens of academic freedom. To view source material used for this episode, visit the website at thatspoliticspodcast.com. Make sure to follow the podcast on Facebook at That's Politics Podcast. Come back next time for the last installment of my DEI series, where we will talk about the role of education in democracy. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and I will see you next time.